Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man, I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, King.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
We are so grateful, Audrey, that you continue to do this and get us linked up with the Blog Talk Radio Network every week when most of us couldn't even do it, plus all the other insights that you provide for us. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Jumble Justice Radio Show, where we at least occasionally try to unjumble some of the criminal justice and crime related news. And welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network. And remember, this is the one where you can have your own radio show. Literally within minutes, you can sign up. It's free unless you go on prime time between like 7 and 10, maybe it's 7 to 9, I forget, but you could be broadcasting worldwide, uninterrupted, to an unlimited number of listeners. And we want to thank Mike Sorrento and Lucy Spears with us also tonight, always in doing research for our show tonight. So, ladies and gentlemen, tonight we have a really, what I would consider a monumental case to discuss. Not since Matt versus Ohio 1968, that was a Cleveland, Ohio police case. And this is one that I've been worried about. I've mentioned it on the show before and other people kind of browse over it. But this idea of the police searching your cell phones, and it's an incredible thing. I mean, your cell phone is now your house. I mean, you could run a small business and your cell phone with the access to the cloud and all the data that you can store, that type of thing. I mean, it literally is your business. And police have been doing searches, not all, but been doing searches all over the country without getting a warrant for this. In other words, they didn't have probable cause. If they had probable cause, they would have gone down, probably gotten a warrant, or at least they didn't think so. But the United States Supreme Court this week just acted, and they unanimously, yes, all the Democrat appointees and the Republican appointees, conservatives and some considered liberals on the United States Supreme Court agreed in the case of Riley versus California and the subsidiary case that the cops need a warrant to search your cell phone. And we're going to listen tonight. Most people only know you can, but you can go to the United States Supreme Court website and you can actually listen to the oral arguments in the presentation of this case. And you'll hear Justice Roberts, Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, start out right away asking questions about to the attorneys presenting this case. So I think you'll enjoy this. And remember, you can hear these cases immediately. After these things, the oral arguments are heard that same day. They go up on the United States Supreme Court website, and you can listen to them or read the entire opinions. And they're usually long. This one's a little bit long, too. But anyway, I think you'll enjoy this tonight. We're going to go a little short on the news, although some of it will relate to these two particular cases talk about the cell phone searches. Both of them were heard together before the United States Supreme Court during oral arguments. Okay, we got a blonde joke for tonight. I picked it out myself, so let me read this one. We never want to lay off on blonde jokes, and you know the internet, I don't think they could count how many blonde jokes are on there. I liked the one last week about the turn signal. Is it working? Yes. No. Yeah. Okay, here's another blonde joke I think you'll enjoy. A dumb blonde was standing in front of a soda machine outside of a local store. After putting in 60 cents, a root beer pops out of the machine. She sets it on the ground, puts 60 cents more into the machine, and pushes another button. Suddenly, a Coke comes out of the machine. She continued to do this until a man waiting to use the machine became impatient. "Excuse me, ma'am," he says, can I get my soda, and then you can go back to whatever stupid thing you're doing?" The blonde turns around and says, "Yeah, right. I'm not giving up this machine while I'm still winning." I'm not giving up this machine while still winning. Okay, I thought that was a particularly good one. And listen, ladies and gentlemen, we know the planet's getting warmer. We want to stop the planet from burning up. Although the data is beginning to show quite the opposite, depending on what data you look at. Now we've actually found out from some studies that they've been, fudging the data on the side of global warming, and the people that have been making money off of this, let's start with Al Gore, former vice president of the United States, making all this money. But anyway, we have a green tip for tonight. I thought you would enjoy this. Well, let me know how this one works out for you. Give the power grid a break during hot summer months. Turn off your air conditioner. Put some ice in a bowl in front of a small fan. Plug in the fan, turn it on, and aim it over the bowl. Aim it right over the bowl, and you'll be cool because it will blow the ice-cooled air right out in front of you. So let me know how that works out, and then count out and figure out how much energy you're spending doing that. Let me know if it's actually less than running running your air conditioner. Who actually knows? Most people wouldn't. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's listen to the Ohio Coalition's public service announcement against firearms, because you know these guns kill people. I think the Ohio Coalition forgets sometimes that 300,000 people a year use a firearm to ward off a felon. But anyway, guns do kill. Or is it people that kill? Anyway, let's listen to their public service announcement.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. Let me knock off some news here real quick. The first one has to do with the two cases that we'll be talking about here this evening. We're going to listen to the arguments just on Riley versus California. That's the first one that they heard of the two having to do with the cell phone searches. It says, in an emphatic defense of privacy in the digital age, this is by Mark Sherman, a unanimous Supreme Court ruled Wednesday that police generally may not search cell phones of people they arrest without getting search warrants. And there's all kinds of, not all kinds, but there's a list of things that make a search legal. With a warrant, that's the best way. If no other thing, if you have time, get a warrant. Incident to a lawful arrest, in other words, I'm arresting somebody and they may have a gun, I can search them. A moving vehicle search, that has limitations too, where you can do searches. A consent search, you can ask somebody if you can search them. If they give you permission, that's perfectly legal. Statutory authority, special cases like at the border, when you're flying into the United States, maybe not the border, but when you're flying into an airport and you go through a search, or you're leaving to board a plane to go overseas, you can be searched. So that covers most of the searches that we're talking about. But this cell phone search thing is really interesting. And Chief Justice Roberts, he said that cell phones are unlike anything else police may find when they arrest someone. They are not just another technological inconvenience, he said, but ubiquitous, increasingly powerful computers that contain vast quantities of personal sensitive information. And with all they contain and all they reveal, they hold for many Americans the privacies of life. This is Chief Justice Roberts saying this. And he says the best way to handle this type of search is get a warrant. And I think this is going to be earth-shed. I've talked about this for 4 or 5 years. I can't believe it took it this long to get to it. But it's really very important that goes on. Did you know the drug cartels are actually using these children down on the border to make more room for them to slip drugs and known criminals into the country? What they're doing, they're dropping these kids off between Border Patrol posts. In other words, so the Border Patrol will have to travel as far as it can. And nearly 40% of the Border Patrol manpower now has been shifted to manage these children. Can you believe this? Thousands of these kids coming across, and we can't stop this. The Minuteman proved, I went down there, the Minuteman proved that you can, in fact, close the border. I went and viewed it in Arizona. But these cartels purposely cross between ports of entry to tie up the Border Patrol manpower. And Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson admitted Tuesday he was stumped by the surge, acknowledging that conditions in Central America have been poor for some time and cannot account for the spike in recent months, which has sent more than 10,000 unaccompanied children across the border. Well, they're unaccompanied for a while. I mean, a seven-year-old didn't take off from Guatemala and then walk up there by themselves. So anyway, we mentioned last week one of the articles where they actually got Border Patrol agents on occasion changing diapers. And did you see this? The mayor of Springfield, Massachusetts, they're sending him up to Springfield, Massachusetts, some of these children. He said, stop it. He said, we got our own problems. We can't afford this myself. I haven't read much about that article. But anyway, he says, stop this. And this is in the state of Massachusetts. So kind of interesting. Here's Microsoft's general counsel, and guess what he's worried about? He says, Microsoft, their future is bleak if the government continues unlawful data collection. Microsoft's top lawyers keeping up the pressure on the federal government to end its secret data collection. A lot of people are doing that. This is Brad Smith. He says, I want law enforcement to do its job in an effective way pursuant to the rule of law. He said at the Brookings Institute in Washington, D.C., if we can't get to the world, then law enforcement is going to have a bleak future anyway. If we can't get to that world, he's talking about the idea that we have to stop collecting this data secretly. And he says by the end of this decade, there will be 50 billion devices connected to the Internet of Things around the world. This issue is going to become more important, not less. But who would have thought that Microsoft would stand out? Of course, it's a business decision for them also. If people feel their information isn't safe, they're not going to use Microsoft products, applications, et cetera. But he says, we're in a business that relies on people's trust. We're offering a world where you should feel comfortable about storing information in the cloud. You need to have confidence that this information is still yours. But I find that rather incredible. That this is actually going on. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think I'm going to skip the last one. It's more about the cops becoming more and more militarized. And a lot of people are tired of that. We've had people on about the written books about the militarization of the American police departments. And a lot of people are starting to write about this. And they're using all this equipment that's coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and wherever, and they're making raids where, almost innocent people, where they're suspected of something, or they're having 13 people show up or 25 and tanks and tank type of vehicles and all that when they, two cops used to handle this 30 years ago and before, sometimes one by themselves. So anyway, that's it for this. Would you give me time to set up the United States Supreme Court's oral arguments about this week about the cell phone searches. And the case we're going to hear is Riley versus California. And you'll get to actually hear the justices and the attorneys discuss this very important case. This is landmark. This is the biggest decision we've had in over 50 years relative to privacy. So give me a second to get it set up.
Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case involves applying the core protection of the Fourth Amendment to a new factual circumstance. It has always been the case that an occasion of an arrest did not give the police officers authority to search through the private papers in the drawers and bureaus and cabinets of somebody's house. And that protection should not evaporate more than 200 years after the founding, because we have the technological development of smartphones that have resulted in people carrying that information in their pockets.
Just to test the principle for why the police can search and see some objects, consider a gun. The arrestee has a gun on his person, and the police take the gun. Is part of the reason for that seizure to obtain evidence of the crime, or is it just for the safety of the officer and the safety of the community?
Well, what this court said in Robinson at page 235 is the reason supporting the authority for a search incident to arrest are the two Chamel factors, which are gathering evidence to prevent its destruction and officer safety. Now,
gathering evidence in order to make the crime. For instance, with the gun, could they take the fingerprints of the gun is in the police station with the arrestee is being booked. A, could they take fingerprints? B, could they copy the serial number? C, could they see how many shells were left in the chamber? They obviously have to empty it for safety purposes. All for the purpose of building the case, of obtaining evidence.
Yes, of course, that's done every day. Once the gun is in the police department's lawful possession, I think Edwards says that they can do all that.
So if the proposition then, if the principle then, is that some objects that are obtained from the arrestee can be examined in order to build the state's case, is that at least a beginning premise that we can accept in your case, although obviously there are problems of the extent and intrusiveness of the search that are in your case but not in the gun hypothetical?
Well, Justice Kennedy, the court has never described that as one of the things. If you want to think about this case the way you thought about the automobile search in Gantt, it would be a beginning premise. But I think you're right that even if that were a beginning premise, it would be only that, a beginning. In footnote 9 in Edwards, this court said that any search incident to arrest still has to satisfy the Fourth Amendment's general reasonableness.
I think you're right. That Gantt is probably the best statement in support of the principle that I've suggested, and then you might say, well, that's limited to automobiles,
right.
And then we're back to where we started.
Right, and there's important things to understand if you want to start thinking about Gantt, because both in terms of its history and its modern application, it's dramatically different from what we have here.
Well, Mr. Fisher, before we do that, have you been accurate in what you said about Robinson and about the court's cases? In Weeks, which was quoted in Robinson, the court said the right always recognized under English and American law to search the person of the accused when legally arrested to discover and seize the fruits or evidences of crime. Is that historically inaccurate? Do you want us to repudiate that?
No, Your Honor. What Weeks said, you quoted it, fruits and instrumentalities of the crime have always been something that could be seized from a person. Now, Weeks, of course, as this court said in Robinson itself, was dicta, and there was that historical authority to take fruits and instrumentalities.
Did it say instrumentalities or evidence? Just to say.
Weeks,
Justice Alito said evidence. You changed it to instrumentality. Is one of you wrong?
Weeks uses the word evidence, but Justice Scalia, because it was not an issue in that case. The Bishop treatise that you cited in your Thornton concurrence talks about tools and instrumentalities. Now, I don't think we have to debate that here, because even if we're in a world where the police can seize some evidence and keep it and use it for the prosecution simply for that reason, even if they don't fear destruction. There are still very, very profound problems with searching a smartphone without a warrant. Because even under the Robinson rule, this court has recognized, for example, when it comes to blood draws, something like a strip search that might occur at the scene, there are limits even to the Robinson rule.
Well, smartphones do present difficult problems, but let me ask you this. Suppose your client were an old-school guy, and he didn't have a cell phone. He had a billfold, and he had photos that were important to him in the billfold. He had that at the time of arrest. Do you dispute the proposition that the police could examine the photos in his billfold and use those as evidence against him?
No. That's the rule of Robinson, that any physical item on an arrestee can be seized and inspected and then used as evidence if it's useful evidence. We draw a line.
Yeah, what is the difference between looking at hard copy photos in a billfold and looking at photos that are saved in the memory of a cell phone?
The difference is digital information versus physical items. Physical items at the scene can pose a safety threat and have destruction possibilities that aren't present with digital evidence. What is more, once you get into the digital world, you have the framers' concern of general warrants and the writs of assistance.
How does that apply to these hard copy photos in the billfold? They don't present a threat to anybody. And I don't see that there's much of a difference between the government argues there's a greater risk of the destruction of digital evidence in a cell phone than there is in the photos. So I don't quite understand how that applies to that situation.
Well, let me take those one thing at a time. I take it the theory of Robinson, this is the theory the government itself propounded, is that any physical item, because it contained a razor blade or a pin or anything, needs to be inspected to be sure. And so you have a categorical rule because of the ad hoc nature of arrests that police don't have to distinguish physical items one from the other.
Well, but in New Orleans, let's just stick with Justice Alito's hypothetical. They find a business card or something which shows a car rental service, and they turn the card over and read it. They're not looking for a pin or an explosive. They're trying to read what's on the card. Can they do that?
I think they can, and there's nothing else under plain view when it's in their hand, Justice Kennedy. But I really don't want to fight.
They turn the card over.
I think that is fine under the categorical rule. I think what you have in Robinson is a categorical rule that obviates these exact difficult case-by-case determinations. You could make an argument that if I needed to, if it were a diary case or a billfold case, you might be able to make an argument, but I think the court wisely decided under Robinson that we need a categorical rule that's easily administrable in the field. Now, when you have digital evidence, the categorical rule we submit cuts exactly in the opposite direction. Because digital information, even the notion of flipping through photos in a smartphone, implicates vast amounts of information, not just the photos themselves, but the GPS locational data that's linked in with it, all kinds of other information that is intrinsically intertwined in smartphones.
Including information that is specifically designed to be made public. I mean, what about something like Facebook or a Twitter account? Any privacy interest in a Facebook account is at least diminished because the point is you want these things to be public and seen widely.
Well, Mr. Chief Justice,
I guess my question would be, could you have a rule that the police are entitled to search those apps that, in fact, don't have a hair of privacy about them?
I think that would be extraordinarily difficult to administer that rule. Let me tell you why. Because most of the information on smartphones is private. Much of it is just, like the photos in this case, just kept on somebody's phone and not shared with anybody. Even a Facebook account is a limited universe of people who have access to it. You're right.
It's more or less limited. I mean, you know, maybe it's 20 people, maybe it's 100 people, but it's certainly not private in the sense that many of the other applications are.
I think it's fair to say you have a sliding scale, and there's some stuff on a phone that might be posted on the Internet, for example. The difficulty with that case, if you wanted to address it in a future case, would be the intertwined nature of information on a phone. So looking at those photos in a smartphone account will be linked to the contacts inside the phone. It will be linked to GPS information inside the phone. All of this information is intertwined, and I think you'd have a difficult administrability problem if you wanted to create some sort of rule like that. Now, remember, the government might try to deal with that problem differently by saying information in the cloud, so to speak, is not accessible to officers. We submit that just further would compound the difficulty of applying a rule in this circumstance.
Do you think in this case we have to decide whether all the information that may be available in a smartphone can be examined by the police when the owner of the phone is arrested, or can we just focus on the particular evidence that was admitted in your client's trial?
Well, the way you phrased the question, I think that's the first cut at this, is looking at the particular pieces of evidence here, which are photos and videos. But we don't think you can write an opinion that would distinguish those from anything else on almost anything else on a smartphone. I mean, the state's argument here is that those are not, quote, fundamentally different from other things that people would carry.
Do you think you could obtain a warrant, or that the police could have obtained a warrant in this case?
In all likelihood, yes, Justice Kennedy, and they had plenty of time to do so.
Well, then the evidence that's feasible under the warrant is reasonable, and Justice Alito points out the fact that some of this evidence is reasonable. If there's a limitation with reference to the way the police behave, as Justice Alito points out, it's limited just to this evidence.
Well, let me say a couple important things about the warrant requirements and then return to Justice Alito's question. This court has said time and again that the mere fact the police could have gotten a warrant but didn't does not excuse a Fourth Amendment violation. Let me say a couple things about the warrant requirement and then return to Justice Alito.
Well, but it just goes to the fact that this is searchable under Fourth Amendment standards.
With a warrant, Justice Kennedy, and let me talk about why a warrant is so important. First of all, it interposes a neutral observer in between the citizen and the police officer. Perhaps more importantly, it does two very big things. One is it can trigger the Fourth Amendment particularity requirement so that the magistrate can say, this is what you can look at and what didn't. Remember, in this case, the prosecution ultimately introduced photos and videos, but that's not what the detective testified to at trial as to the scope of his search. He said at JA-11, we looked at a whole lot of stuff on the phone, and that's just what, in his words, caught his eye.
So how would it work for the magistrate? I mean, you recognize, you just told Justice Kennedy, that a warrant could be obtained. A warrant for what? What would the police have to show? Let's take your birth date. So they have seized, with proper, seized their phone, they secured it, and now they want to search it. So they sign for a warrant, and what would the warrant have to say?
We give an example of a warrant in a footnote in our reply brief. I believe it's footnote 3, Justice Ginsburg. And there are many more available on the web from states that already require warrants. What they do is they say the police officer testifies, perhaps somewhat like he testified here at the suppression hearing, I suspected this fellow was in a gang, and I believe gang members keep certain kinds of things on their phone. This is the kind of crime that we're investigating, and therefore these particular files within the phone are likely to obtain evidence. And then what happens is the warrants say with particularity, here's the things you can look at, here's what you can't. More importantly, Justice Ginsburg, a warrant requirement.
You've told us that that's hard to figure out what you can and what you can't. But it's easy for a magistrate, but impossible for an arresting officer?
I think much easier for a magistrate at some remove than an officer under the stresses in the field. Now, just perfectly, I agree, it's not going to be perfect. And so let's look at what happens
on the same lines as Justice Scalia. The point you make elsewhere in your brief argument is that the cell phone or the smartphone has everything. It's got the person's whole life. Well, if you're arresting somebody on the grounds of suspicion that he's a gang member and you have evidence to support that, what part of the smartphone is not likely to have pertinent evidence? What application is not? I mean, here you've got pictures, you've got videos, you've got calls. I guess it's similar to what other issues have been raised. I don't know what a magistrate is supposed to put in the warrant.
I would say his banking app.
You don't think the banking app is going to say on this day he deposited $10,000 into his account?
Well,
and then that's going to coincide with a particular drug deal.
Well, Mr. Chief Justice, those arguments can be made on an app-by-app basis, but what happens is this is the benefit of our rule as opposed to the government. What the government says is let the officer look and then have a back-end hearing where you just suppress all the stuff that he wasn't supposed to look at once you apply particularity requirements. Under our rule, once the officer has the warrant, Leon kicks in. And so you don't have to have all these hearings in district courts, because once an officer does a proper search according to the orders of a warrant, you don't have to have the kind of suppression hearing. And there's one other very important thing that goes into a warrant, which might have been glossed over too quickly in the briefs. It's not just what can be looked at. It's how it can be kept. And the retention of information raises extraordinary Fourth Amendment concerns. My understanding in California is, at least for some crimes, it's not just that they're downloading the information and looking at it for the crime of arrest, but they're keeping this information in databases, ever-growing databases of every cell phone that they've ever...
What if you have a device that doesn't have the broad information a smartphone has, but only a very limited, like a Fitbit that tells you how many steps you've taken? The defendant says, I've been in my house all afternoon, and they want to check and see if he's walked 4 miles. And it's not his whole life, which is a big part of your objection. Is that something they can look at?
I think probably not. And I think this is the way the categorical rule in Robinson, where it sweeps in the kind of hypotheticals we were talking about in one direction. I think a categorical rule in the other direction for digital information would sweep in the Fitbit. I mean, obviously, I don't have to win that argument today, but I think that's how you would approach that question. Remember, the Fitbit, and this is true even more so of smartphones, tells you just the kind of information the court was very concerned about in Kylo. It tells you... modern smartphones work the inside of people's house. They work the appliances, and they have cameras. They also monitor the inside of people's bodies.
What if the phone in this case was an old-fashioned flip phone? So it had the capacity to take pictures, but a much more limited memory. Would it be a different case?
Well, I think you may want to – that'll be part of your conversation in the next case, perhaps. I think the easiest way to decide the case right now in 2014 – to simply say digital evidence kept on modern cell phones are different than physical items. I don't think it's really worth going back in time to the most rudimentary device.
What if the person had on his person a compact disc with photos saved on that?
I think that might be the same kind of cases you have now. Remember the phone in this case had a removable memory card, as many still do, which, by the way, we were going to talk about destruction of evidence. That's one answer to the destruction of evidence problem. It couldn't possibly have arisen with respect to the evidence at issue because it was on a removable memory card that couldn't be erased remotely or password protected. Now, we've given lots of arguments in the brief that explain why the government's arguments as to wiping simply don't stand up.
Mr. Fisher, would you, an earlier question, you didn't finish the answer. You were describing a difference between the downloading by police into databases that they keep forever. What happens with materials that are returned pursuant to a search warrant? Are they precluded from doing that?
No.
I wasn't sure I understood your...
Right. So I take it that the ordinary rule is that the police lawfully sees evidence in the physical world. If it's a physical item, it might at some point have to be returned to the owner of it. But if it's something that can be made a photocopy of or a photo, you know, remains in police files, it's lawfully obtained information, they can use indefinitely into the future. You have real problems, however, when you apply that typical rule to digital information. Because now, again, what I understand, the government itself and the federal government in footnote 3 of its reply brief in Worry acknowledges that it's keeping in a ever-growing federal database at least some of the information seized from smartphones.
I'm sorry, I don't know that you've answered.
I'm sorry, maybe I didn't understand.
Which, can it do the same thing once a search warrant is issued?
Oh, no. Well, not necessarily, because the beauty of a search warrant is it can delineate retention rules. It can say, here's how long you're allowed to keep the information. Here's who's allowed to look at it and who's not. And it can,
frankly, I have to tell you, I don't ever remember a prosecutor coming to me with that kind of delineation.
Well, I think that, Justice Sotomayor, that is what is starting to now happen in the digital world, because we just have new and different concerns that had arisen in the
Mr. Fisher, would there be exigencies that would allow police to look at cell phones, and if so, what would those exigencies be?
Absolutely. There would be times at the scene where exigencies would allow it. First of all, the two officer safety arguments the other side makes about a hypothetical bomb or a Confederate ambush as this court already recognized in Chadwick, would get exigent circumstances. The concern about remote wiping, we think, and as the experts have described in the amicus brief filed by Epic and many others, we don't think would ever arise, give rise to a situation where that was a legitimate concern, but in a very odd world, yes.
I don't understand your first exigent circumstances. When there is a bomb, but you don't know whether there is a bomb until you look in the phone. Whether his associates are on the way to, to kill the officer and release their confederate, you don't know until you look into the phone. So how can that possibly be an exigent circumstance?
Well, I think the surrounding facts and circumstances, and footnote 9 in Chadwick, what the court said, dealing with a locked briefcase, Reed has the same problem, Justice Scalia, surrounding facts and circumstances might indicate. There's a hypothetical, I believe it's on page 1 of the amicus brief filed by the state investigative agencies, that I think gives a classic textbook example of how exigent circumstances might apply.
It seems to me it would almost never, never be able to say, surrounding circumstances give me reason to suspect that there's a bomb in the phone.
No,
give me reason to suspect that his Confederates are on the way.
I think you're right that that's going to be an extraordinarily rare circumstance. All I'm saying is if you have that extraordinarily rare circumstance, you would not need to get a warrant.
There's not much authority that I could find. If the lawyer is arrested and they want to read his whole briefcase or you want to read his year's diary, you cite, I think it's page 7 of your brief, the Learned Hand 1916 case. Is that about the best discussion you can find? I didn't find anything much different.
Justice Kennedy, we looked high and low as well,
right,
and did not find cases involving briefcases full of documents. And there's only one or two stray mentions of a diary. Judge Friendly also mentions the diary situation.
Because it's important if we're going to try to formulate some standard which limits the extent of the search, and that's one of the problems in this case. If say we rule for the government in its case, maybe it's not quite fair to ask you, but if we rule for the government in its case, in worry for the federal case, and there's no, it's not an exigent circumstance, is there some standard where we could draw the line which would still result in a judgment in your favor? Maybe that's not quite a fair question. You're not arguing the government's case.
I don't want to tread on both lawyers in that case, but certainly in my case, we have an exploratory search where not even the state was contended the amount of information looked at is equivalent to what somebody could have carried around in the old days. Can I say something?
I'm going to say something first.
Okay.
If the phone rings, can the police answer it?
There are cases on that, Mr. Chief Justice. Obviously, this court hasn't addressed them. All the cases we've found are cases where the police already had a warrant in hand, and they've been held that, yes, the police officers can answer the phone in that circumstance. Unquestionably, the police officers could look at the screen.
A warrant for what? A warrant
for somebody's arrest?
For somebody's arrest. Well, how does that extend to your ability to answer his phone?
No, I'm sorry, Mr. Justice Scalia. I think also to effectuate an arrest and an immediate search of the area. Now, certainly you could look at the caller ID coming through because that would be in plain view, but if I can return to Justice Kennedy's question about the diary, because there's a couple of important aspects to that I hope to be able to draw out. The reason I think that you don't find diary cases when you look for them is because people hardly ever carry a diary outside the home with them. It was kept in the private drawer in the bedroom or wherever it might be kept. And in the highly, highly unusual circumstance where somebody did, you might have a hard case. This is the opposite world. The modern reality of smartphones is it is an indispensable item for everyday life of a modern professional and indeed most anyone. You can't leave the house without it and be consider yourself to be responsible and safe. And so to take the world where the police might try to say, we can get the stray diary because of the importance of a categorical rule under Robinson, and try to apply that into a world where everybody has everything with them at all times.
Well, including the criminals who are more dangerous, more sophisticated, more elusive with cell phones. That's the other side of this.
Well, Justice Kennedy, the Fourth Amendment has a balance already built in that respect. We're not saying they can't look at digital information. We're just saying that when they seize it,
they can freeze the content and then go get a warrant and search what they're allowed to search and keep it under the rules of that warrant.
Well, all significant in this case that the information was not protected by a password?
No, I don't think either side.
That doesn't affect the expectation of privacy?
If the other side were making an argument that this wasn't even a search, then I think that might be an argument they would deploy. But I think, and I don't want to speak for the government, but I think that they also agree that password protection doesn't matter. And it certainly doesn't matter under their argument as to what information they get. I mean, their position is, if we see the corporate executive's smartphone at the scene that is locked and protected under password, if we can get that information out back at our lab, we get it all, and we don't have to ask for a warrant, and we can keep it as long.
No, I know they argue that it doesn't matter, but I'm just wondering if your position is weakened by the fact that the individual did not seek the greater protection of a password.
No, I don't think so. People don't lock their homes. They don't lock their briefcases. Simply having it inside the smartphone protected on the person is enough to trigger the Fourth Amendment, and I think to sustain the arguments I've advanced. If I could reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Dumont?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. As Mr. Fisher has said, if Mr. Riley had been carrying physical photographs in his pocket at the time of his arrest, there's no dispute that arresting officers could have looked at those photographs to see whether they contain evidence of crime. Now, what would have been reasonable in that situation does not become constitutionally unreasonable simply because Mr. Riley instead carried his photographs in digital form on a smartphone. The shift to digital format does not make the photographs any less his paper.
Also, as in one of our court decisions in the past, a series of justices asked or noted that many of our rules were based on practical considerations. Practically speaking, a person can only carry so much on their person. That is different because carrying a billfold of photographs is a billfold of photographs. It's, you know, anywhere from 1 to 5 generally, not much more. But now we're talking about potentially thousands, because with digital cameras, people take endless photos, and it spans their entire life. You don't see a difference between the two things. What has now become impractical. A GPS can follow people in a way that prior following by police officers and cars didn't permit.
We certainly see a distinction, and we certainly see the possibility that in some cases there could potentially be a constitutional difference. What we don't see is that in this case, on the facts of this case, or anything like it, and like the ordinary case, there's a constitutional difference from those phenomena. The theory, even if I'm carrying only 5 photographs, or if I'm carrying 2 letters, as was the case in the Chiago case, for instance, that then Judge Cardozo decided in the 20s, they're likely to be very personal, very private photographs. So I'm not sure that the expansion of volume increases the invasion of privacy.
Mr. Dumont, on your argument, and on the government's, the Solicitor General's principal arguments, too, a person can be arrested for anything. A person can be arrested for driving without a seatbelt. And the police could take that phone and could look at every single email that person has written, including work emails, including emails to family members, very intimate communications, could look at all that person's bank records, could look at all that person's medical data, could look at that person's calendar, could look at that person's GPS and find out every place that person had been recently because that person was arrested for driving without a seatbelt. Now, that strikes me as a very different kind of world than the kind of world that you were describing where somebody has pictures of their family in a billfold. Doesn't it strike you that way?
I think the answer there, one can always think of marginal cases where there might be concern. It is not the core case.
I don't know why this is a marginal case.
It is not the
core. Your argument and the Solicitor General's principal argument applies to any arrest, and it applies to everything on a cell phone. People carry their entire lives on cell phones. That's not a marginal case. That's the world we live in, isn't it?
We hear that repeatedly. The facts of this case are not somebody's entire life on a cell phone. This cell phone had a handful of
contacts. I don't think it's in the record, but what we understand is there were 250-some-odd contacts, there were about 59 photos, and there were perhaps 42 videos that restrained 30 to 45 seconds, maybe a minute.
It serves to make a rule not for this particular case, but for this category of cases, and I think that this is being pointed out, is very nervous concern. That is, take an offense like failing to buckle up, even driving under the influence. It's not violent crimes, which is what we have in this case. It's your rule, then, that the cell phone is fair game no matter what the crime, no matter how relatively unimportant the crime is. It all makes a meaning. All misdemeanors, and that opens the world.
It is true that the court typically and properly in this area draws categorical lines, and that is what the court said in Robinson was doing. Now, it also is true the court has repeatedly said that those lines are drawn based on the generality of cases. They are not drawn based on the marginal case or the hypothetical potential problematic case. Now, this case is in the heartland. It's a violent...
Well, Mr. DeMuth, I guess what I'm trying to suggest to you is that you call it marginal, but in fact, most people now do carry their lives on cell phones, and that will only grow every single year as, you know, young people take over the world. I mean, that's not a marginal case. That's what their computers, they have as much computing capacity as laptops did 5 years ago, and everybody under a certain age, let's say under 40, has everything on them.
I think you need to look at the generality of cases, and in the generality of cases, first of all, you will not be dealing with minor crimes. You'll be dealing with serious crimes. And second, you'll be dealing with police who are trying to do their job.
Are you saying we're just resting on the discretion of the officer? Because if that's so, then it leads to the next question. Well, if that's so, then we'll get a warrant.
Saying that you're trying to draw lines that can be applied by the officer in the field, and often when there is not time to get a warrant, either because there's a need to know the information now, or because...
Let's leave exigent circumstances out of it. That's an easy case. But you're not arguing for exigent circumstances here.
What I'd say is, to go back to Justice Scalia's point, our argument is that the same things that Mr. Fisher concedes... same interest that Mr. Fisher, I think, concedes justify the search of the person and the seizure of the phone, which are the exigent circumstances type arguments. In other words, they are the need to protect officer safety and the need to preserve evidence. And the fact is you don't know with a phone, the officer doesn't know with a phone whether there's a safety concern or whether there's an evidentiary concern without
Is there any basis for the generality that there's a safety concern? Do you have a case where the, certainly not where the phone exploded, but when the phone was used to trigger a device or anything like that?
We don't have a specific case. What I can point you to, here's a case from California. I don't think it's cited in the briefs. It's called Let's Hold Wait. There's one where there's a late night arrest. It starts with a speeding ticket, and it's off the highway late at night. It develops that, you know, maybe there's more going on. The person looks to be under the influence. He's taken out of the car, then it looks like there might be a gun. The officer looks at the cell phone. The first thing he sees when he turns the phone on is a picture of what appears to be the driver standing with two assault rifles, arms akimbo like this, posing with his assault rifles. Now, I would say that that changes the situational awareness of the officer in that situation and provides valuable information that was necessary at the time and could not have been gotten later at the station house.
What does that have to do with my question about a bomb?
I'm merely saying it has to do with safety. So, no, I can't bring you a case where they stopped Timothy McVeigh and looked at his phone and saw some notes about bomb making. I can't give you
that. I would assume you need to operate the phone to set off the bomb so that once the police have the phone, the bomb's not going to be set off.
That is true, but it's also true of all the objects in all the court's prior cases. In other words, once in Robinson, we had secured the cigarette pack. There was no question that whether there was a razor blade in it or just heroin, it's not going to be destroyed.
Can I ask you a question about the extent of your theory? We're talking about smartphones, which are mini computers, but your theory would apply to iPads, computers, anything that's, for example, sitting next to a person in a car, at their desk if they're arrested at their desk,
anywhere if they're carrying it in their hand, because you see a lot of people carry the iPad or something comparable, a tablet of some sort. Your theory would permit a search of all of those things.
If you're there, objects that are on the person or immediately associated with, for instance, in a purse, it doesn't necessarily extend to things that are sitting nearby. The cord has drawn a clear line there. It's a lot.
So what is the rule? You say on the person. Suppose it's in the car in the holder, or suppose it's in the passenger seat. Are you saying that you don't want to express an opinion about that?
No.
You only want to talk about what's in somebody's pocket?
I'll say I think the court has drawn different rules for that situation. It's on the car seat, and if the person's been removed from the car, then under Gant, if there's reason to think there might be evidence of the crime of arrest on the phone, they can search it, and if there's not, they can't. That's the rule of the court, too, but it's a different rule.
Well, suppose I'm carrying my laptop in my backpack.
And if your backpack is on your back when you're arrested, yes, we think that's included. So let me go back to the volume question, because there are two things about a cell phone that might justify some sort of special rule. There's the volume question, and then there's the connectivity and networking question. Now, as to the volume question, first of all, we don't really have it here, but I concede that we could have it in other cases. And what they seem to be really concerned about is the idea that you have enough information of enough different kinds on this device, and the police spend enough time looking at it, they could build the kind of remarkable portrait that some of the justices alluded to in Jones, that it really would be qualitatively different from what has ever been done before. Now, there are differences from Jones. That was government surveillance, and this is some choice the person has made to keep a certain amount of information on the phone and then to have it in his pocket. But we think there's a possibility you could get to that kind of qualitatively different search, but it is miles away from this kind of case and from the heartland.
Okay, so what's your rule?
So there
are three possibilities. Possibility one, smartphone. No, get a warrant, unless exigent circumstance. Possibility two, yes, it's just like a piece of paper that you find in his pocket. Or possibility three, sometimes yes, sometimes no. All right, which of those three are yours?
Our position is that the core information like this, that is contacts, photos.
No, of my three choices. I mean, call the first choice never accept exigent without a warrant. Always, you don't need a warrant. Or three, somewhere in between. Which of the three choices is yours?
In between with an explanation.
In between, okay. Yeah. Now we're in between, then I get to my follow-up
question.
My follow-up question is, please tell me what your in-between rule is.
Right, and my in-between rule with the explanation is that for information that is of the same sort that police have always been able to seize from the person, that includes diaries, letters, all other kinds of evidence, purely evidentiary photographs, address books. For evidence of that same sort, the same rules should apply. The digital format
does not make a difference.
I would leave for a different day. Sorry, but the last explanation for this is I would leave for another case.
Mr. DeMott,
the question of whether the volume...
I'm sorry, just this meeting.
Mr. DeMott, I guess I just don't understand that. You said if it could be, I mean, everything could be reduced to a piece of paper, or your bank records, you could have them on you, or your medical records, you could just happen to have them on you. I mean, that would be so with absolutely everything, wouldn't it?
The bank records, of course, the police can get from the bank because they're the bank's records, right? With a subpoena, not with a search warrant.
The notion that you could get them legally in some other way has never justified an illegal search otherwise.
No, but I think it goes to the question of how sensitive is this information that we're being told is now routinely.
So your rule is sometimes. So I say, sometimes, what's that? And you say, if it's the kind of thing that the police could have searched for if it wasn't on the computer, then they can search for it on the computer. Now, since they can search for everything in your pockets when it isn't the computer, then why isn't yours everything? I mean, by the way, they don't know whether a call is or is not going to turn out to be evidence when it's in your trash box, if that's or wherever you put it, I don't know. They don't know that until they read it. So I guess what you're saying is, I thought it was Category 2 sometimes, but really it's Category 3 always. Now, why am I wrong?
I think he inverted 2 and 3.
We did not assign.
I give you time to think.
If the police are looking for, have a legitimate investigative purpose, for looking at the information on the phone, see whether there's evidence of the crime of arrest or of another crime, it seems to us that they should, at a minimum, be able to look at the same kind of information they could have looked at in any other previous context. The address book, the context, the phone
number. So, but that's a significant concession on your part, isn't it? Because these smartphones carry a lot of information that would not have been the sort of thing police could look at before. GPS tracking information. The police could never have gotten that before. So you're saying that is protected?
I'm not saying it's protected. I'm saying that it raises a different set of issues.
It seems to me that in order to try to give some answer to Justice Kagan's concerns, that maybe the distinction ought to be between serious and non-serious offenses. I don't.
Well, I hope you enjoy this. There's more of it to play, about another 30 minutes, I think. But one of the things that you discover, if you've never heard the Supreme Court arguments, is that the justices do have a sense of humor. And that's pretty much throughout history, actually. But you can actually go to the United States Supreme Court website and hear the oral arguments concerning every case that goes to the United States Supreme Court, which is a marvelous resource for people generally interested in that and those who are deeply interested in it as lawyers or criminal justice professors, police officers, police officials, managers, etc. And they make decisions on all kinds of things, and it's across the prisons, the courts, the police, juvenile justice areas, that type of thing. So it's a marvelous resource. It's the United States Supreme Court site, and all you have to do is Google that, and it'll take you right there, and the audio arguments are real easy to find. Well, that does it for tonight. We'll see you next week, and we'll have Vera Lynn sign us off, as she usually does, saying we'll meet again.
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know. Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing. We'll meet again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know.